Sorry, Paola, could you repeat, please? What did you say?
Well, I will be waiting a couple of minutes more. I don't know if there is anyone coming.
You can start, Paola, if it's time to start.
Rupert, we cannot hear you.
Sorry, I said if it is time to start, you can start. We are here. So.
Okay. I think that we may be going to start. And good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session. The first speaker of today will be Juan Rino Silvestre, speaking about autoencoders for radiation transfer. Please.
So good morning, everyone. I'm Jean. And today, that's a bit of a change of topic. Instead of just talking about the application of autoencoders to emulations, I'll also talk about a bit the work of Maya Small and her work with principal component analysis. So our project is called EmulArt. And the reason why Maya and I, together with the collaboration of Santiago Rosalgeten, Marco Salewski, and Pedro Villero, are working together, given that some of us work with supernovae, some with host galaxies, some with AGN, is that we're all interested in the... No? It's not working. Oh. Thanks. So as I was saying, it's because we're all interested in the effects of dust, and in the effects of dust in the obscuration of the object that we are studying. So. Dust can obscure the objects in the UV and optical wavelengths, and then lead to an excess flux in that is re-emitted by that same dust in the infrared part of the spectrum. But also, the distribution of dust, its shape and its orientation, can also lead to the polarization of light in a microsite. So here we can see a simulation of just a disk galaxy, and the effect of this dust distribution in the disk, and the effect by just provoked by gravity scattering. But in reality, this is just the effect by the spheroid particles. If we have elongated particles, that are deployed, so they will interact differently with different polarizations. Then the observed polarization can be different. With what this means is that we can use polarization also to study the dust environment that we are measuring with polarimetry. This can be useful not only to study galaxies and their structure, but also to infer properties of supernovae projectors. So how do we do this if we don't know the object? So given the amount of processes that are concurring to that concur to give our observations, we have the necessity to simulate and create models to compare to our observations. One way of doing this is relative transfer. And there are two kinds. You can either solve a model analytically, but given the enormous amount of process that you have to solve, that's simply not practical to give you accurate results. Or you can use a Monte Carlo simulation. And SCRT is a one such program that does Monte Carlo relative transfer. So the results of such let's not go for the results already. How you simulate this is that you model a source in your line of sight. You model a field of particles, a medium surrounding that source, and then you just shoot a number of photon packages, and then you calculate, given some probability density functions, the effects of scattering, absorption, and the emission of that dust environment on the paths of those photons. And you end up with data cubes and SCDs. So data cubes give you just the flux distributions in different wavelengths that you selected, and SCDs give you the spectrum. And the SCDs give you the spectrum of the observed plot. So what we will be using to train our so the cost of these Monte Carlo relative transfer simulations is the resolution and the number of photons that you simulate. So if you want something highly resolved with a lot of photons to get you the right amount of information for your model, you'll have to spend a lot. So for example, one of the objects that you'll see later is a galaxy that was simulated by Maida, which the high resolution version took about 2 days to complete. What we want is to create a pipeline that shortens this computational time. In order for us to be able to create libraries of models that make it easier for us to compare to our observations and not have to guess as much what the right properties are in order to avoid wasting time and resources. So you can see here how the quality of simulations improves with the amount of photons that you shoot in the simulation. And so what we are going to do to create this pipeline is you are going to use low photon number simulations. Then we are going to compress this spectral information, so the amount of features that you see along this axis. We are going to perform an upscaling using a spatial Bayesian inference. And then we are going to decompress back to the regular spectral regime. And this, in our hopes, will yield us an emulation that is not as good as a high photon number simulation, but that can replicate to a certain degree its properties. So regarding the special inference, we are going to use a method that has already been discussed, I think, with everyone present here, which is ENMA, which is a Bayesian inference method that uses spatial correlations between the data to perform those inferences. So this is a method that excels at using sparse data. So as you can see here, a simple 5% sample of the image on the left going through ENMA can yield us a very close reconstruction of the original object. So in Maida's work, she will be using a principal component analysis and a non-negative matrix factorization, which are two very similar methods. The basic description of these methods is that they are going to do a transformation in your feature space in order that every single feature that you get is perpendicular to the other, and that they maximize the variance explainability. So in this case, for example, the principal component analysis of this spread will yield one direction along this long axis, and the other component will be perpendicular to it, which correspond to the highest variance direction. So the basis is orthonormal in order to avoid giving undue importance to features just because their value range is long. And at the end of this transformational basis, the user can just look at the importance of the features or the eigenvalues of the resulting vectors and decide where to set a threshold in order to reduce the dimensionality of this feature space. In NMF, the process is similar. You just choose beforehand how many features you want in the resulting space, and the basis of this size being orthonormal will have all its elements positive as well. In my case, I'll be using autoencoders, which are a neural network that compresses the space while matching the input to itself. So as you can see here, you start with a layer with this many features. You go down until the, you go down, you compress, you reach a latent space where your features are supposed to yield the same information as before, and then you go up, and if everything has been done well and properly trained, you will have the same information as before. At the end, you can separate these encoder and decoder modules, and you can operate in the space, in the latent space. So this is my pipeline. As you can see here, what I'll be doing is, as I said before, getting a low photo number simulation into the input of the trained autoencoder, reduces its dimensionality. And then an extra feature of my autoencoder is that it is a variation of autoencoder. So in the middle, instead of having just a vector latent space, I'll be having a distribution latent space. So besides compressing, I can also generate extra equivalent observations of my data. After sampling, I do the spatial inference, and then I return to the original space with an emulation that's better than the input. So here you can see my results with my initial, my initial implementation. So I worked with an isotropic source surrounded by a spherical dust shell, comprised of silicates and graphite. You can see that the SCD, the integrated SCD, is replicated very well. And that the, well, here you can see that this is just one of the slices, but you can see at least that the reconstruction of the spatial distribution is better than the original. You can see here some metrics regarding the performance compared to the input and the emulation time, which was about 10 minutes. To compare with the original high photo number, this is about 6 to 10 times less. A different view of the same problem. So I then applied the pipeline to same bright source, same dust distribution, but seen in a different angle. So edge on, you can see the paraboloid that we get here. And the performance is as good as before, similar performance metrics, and all in all, very reasonable result. I then tried to apply this to a slightly different dust distribution, so a thicker dust distribution. And my, this image is wrong. Disregard this image. What you should be seeing is that the SCD instead of, the SCD instead of following the reference should be should be overestimated. But you can see the metrics that is not, that's pretty much as good. So the residuals are pretty close to the input, and overall the emulation is overestimated, that the flux not really accounting for the extra material that the photons have to go through. The same over here. I'm really sorry about this. Maybe I can show the SEDs later. So going for the work of Maida, she has implemented this already to a model of this galaxy that comes from Kapoor et al. She had to work with these three realizations of the same model. So 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 photons, seen face on, edge on, and at a random angle that is probably close to 18 degrees or so. The initial test try to establish what would be the right amount of components to use was done on a small cut of this simulation. So you can see here that this is 3000 by 3000 by 50. And she used 600 by 600 centers at in the image. You can see here the results. This bar at the top is the time that takes to do the good simulation, so 2 days and such. Here you can see the bar of not using PCA, so just doing inline on every single slice of the simulation with different amounts of information. And the dots represent the different implementations of PCA and NMF. So you can see here that we go below the time of pure inline at about 10, between 7 and 10 PCA. So that was the number she chose to work with. Here you can see the results of the spatial reconstruction using pure inlon, PCA plus inlon, and MMF plus inlon. In the face-on case, one thing that we realize is that NMF is better at filling information in between than inlon. The residuals that we get are more of a qualitative assessment than a quantitative, because there is missing information here. This has more information, so it's not at all comparative for the performance of both. Because as you can see here, it's in those areas that PCA plus inlon doesn't reconstruct that the NMF plus inlon has the hardest time to get it with the inference. Here you can see the same results for the edge-on case. Again, the same thing. Stuff in the middle is well reconstructed with very low residuals. And stuff in the outskirts, in the PCA plus in the case, gets a bit ignored. And the NMF plus in the case, it is reconstructed, but the inference is not not according to the actual height for the number simulation. And here you have the same thing for the random tilt angle case. So now we can see the SEDs of each of those cases. You can see that the at these scales, both all methods follow the original SED quite well. But when we go down to the residuals, you can see that the PCA plus inlon has the highest residuals with the NMF and the pure inlon not presenting such a high variability per wavelength. Here you have all the results that she got. So here you can see the reason why we choose to do the PCA and the NMF, because as you can see before, okay, inlon can just using inlon gives us the best performance, but it also puts us at an execution time that is just basically the same as the original high for one of the simulations. So there's not much advantage in using it in some cases. Here we can shave, in this particular case, you can shave off about half the time. But if, even so, it's probably because of that is just a smaller spatial grid than the face on and the other cases. So for the PCA and MF inlon, you can see that the execution times are about 32 to 15% depending on the input simulation that you choose to use. This is so using the lowest simulation available, she gets emulation times that are very similar to mine. And with actual better results to a more complicated scenario. So our assessment so far has been that using PCA is using a how should I put it? it's a ready to fly kit. You apply it to every case, you train it in every case that you get, and you will get reasonable results. On the other hand, using autoencoders can generalize more your what you want to do. So you train it on a a set of different simulations so that the model could understand the what it should expect with different geometries, with different dust compositions, with different dust densities. And then you wouldn't have to train it every time. But training such a model is much more expensive than training PCA. And we are now taking a turn in the use of neural networks, given the environmental impact of this in the last few years.
5 minutes.
I'm just finishing, thank you. And so I believe right now that with a few adjustments, using PCA or NMF with EMA would be the go-to approach. What is left to do? So in the case of the autoencoder, if I can improve the training set and maybe the maybe some adjustments to the loss function, maybe it will yield better results for more cases and not just a very specific case like the one that I trained for, which really, well, not good because I couldn't show you the right image, but it is clearly biased. And tweaking sampling strategies to improve the performance would, in principle, also give us better results in the PCA and MMF Placima scenarios. And finally, in order to give a quantitative assessment that covers not only the quality of the reconstruction, but also how much information it adds in relation to the input, we must explore different metrics for that. Well, and that's my presentation, and I'll hopefully take any questions.
Thank you. Is there any question? Maybe we start from the question on site, and people online, if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand or write it in the chat. Is there any question in presence? I cannot see that.
No
question in present. And I don't see any question online. So I think that we can thank the speaker again and introduce the second speaker of the session, which is Daria Katlova. And we will speak about kinematics of extended emitting region around active galaxies. Please, Daria. We cannot hear you, you're muted.
Could you hear me now?
Yes.
And there is everything okay with the slides? Do you see them?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Thank you for an opportunity to give a small talk about our current work in the Special Astrophysical Observatory of Russian Academy of Science with our 6-meter Russian telescope data. And our work is about kinematics of extended ionized gas regions around active galaxies using 3D spectroscopic data. So first of all, what is this extended emission line regions and where they come from? There are three possible ways to create such structures in the accretion process. And the first one is type A. It is when the galactic disk accretes external external gas, like cosmological filaments, but it is hard to detect them. The second one is when gas flow away from the galactic disk, and then became cold and fall down to the galactic disk. And so we can see this external structures of gas beyond the galactic disk. And the third case is the most discussional, I guess. It is when we see some gas beyond the galactic disk in the process of merging of galaxies, interacting systems like the tidal debris and so on. I guess it is the most interesting case for us, and we try to find such structures, and also there are not only interesting for us in case that there is some gas beyond the disk, but the particular case is when we see these structures that are ionized only by active galactic nucleus. So they don't have any other sources of ionization. In the process of accretion, active galactic nucleus could appear and then ionize gas not only in the galactic disk, but far beyond them. When I say far, I mean tens of kiloparsecs away. So how we find those structures? They're really rare. The first step is a search of candidates in different surveys like SDSS or DECALS. It is carried out by volunteers of Galaxy Zoo project. And the second step is, and of course I will explain, candidates search for those here you see blue structures beyond the galactic disk. It is kind of, they know that it's kind of ionized gas, but they don't know the mechanism of ionization. So the second step is a spectral confirmation that this gas is ionized only by active galactic nucleus and not have another sources of ionization like young stars or shock waves. So it is this, we use a long slit spectroscopy for this and just use some special optical diagnostic diagrams to confirm the ionization mechanism using different telescopes, including our 6-meter optical telescope. And the third step is a study of distribution and kinematics of ionized gas in galactic disk and beyond it using our 3D spectroscopy data obtained with the Fabry-Perot interferometer. And it is how our current work is done. So I will say just a few words about our data type. When we get data using Fabry-Perot spectroscopy, we, as a result, we have a data cube in each spexel, and in each spexel, we contains its own spectra of the one emission line. Even we don't have wide spectral range, we have a wide field of view. It is 6 minutes for 6 minutes. It allows us to see how gas moves beyond the galactic disks and study extended ionized gas regions. So that is how it looks like. Here is presented a map of a galaxy, and in each spectrum we have this emission line with a high resolution. So we could understand dispersion and some properties of emission lines. To understand the kinematics of the gas in the disk or beyond it. We use this model of quasi-circular motions. The idea is to derive a velocity map that we get from the our data cube using understanding the Doppler shift of the line and derive this velocity map into elliptical rings with the width of 1 arcsecond. And in each ring, we approximate model map to observable map using quasi-circular approach. And this quotients we use to approximate in each ring are presented on the slide and also described in the Professor Misev work. So our sample of galaxies in this work is consists of five nearby Seyfert galaxies in which we know there are extended emission line regions ionized only by the radiation of active galactic nucleus. Here you see Hubble images, and the green structures means that they are only ionized, but they are, it is emission in double ionized oxygen. And here are some decals pictures. So there are five galaxies, their parameters are here, there. They're nearby galaxies, not so far from us. And so how we conducted our analysis, we just made this quasi-circular motion model and derive it from the observational map to get a residual map, residual velocities map to understand how gas moves without this circular regular motion. Just like here, you see that in center, gas is really interrupted, and maybe we can see also some features in disk, or we can understand if gas lay in the plane of the whole disk or not. So I will say only about two examples in our same sample. The first one is UGC 7342, and that is our maps. So it is a radial velocity of double ionized oxygen. It is observable map, and it is map of dispersion. And here we see that this external gas is dynamically cold. That means that its dispersion of velocity of the gas is lower than 50 kilometers per second. And we see this structure maybe by conical outflow in this galaxy with the high values of dispersion. And then we made this model map for just circular motions of the gas and extrapolated to the extended parts of the galaxy and beyond the galaxy and get this the residual velocities map. And we see that all values of residual velocities in extended regions are pretty like the values in the center of galaxy, in the disk of galaxy. So we understand that they are in the plane of the galactic disk. Of course, to conduct this analysis, we need to understand special orientation parameters such as inclination and position angle of major axis of the galactic disk. And we did this as our first assumption of it. Of course, we don't know them clearly. the first assumption was made by the isophotal analysis using decals, deep images in the RF filter. And of course, we understand that there are emergent system in the process of merging, and of course, gas distribution will not follow the distribution of stars, and maybe our star disk is really interrupted. We don't we understand this thing, and so we compared the position angles of the gas using data from our kinematic maps and the data from the Descartes survey to understand the property the position angles of the stars. So here we see that in this galaxy they're pretty the same, but we of course don't have any information about stars in the external parts of the galaxies because there are no stars at all. It is just a gas ionized by the AGN. And the second case is this galaxy CG-077-117. And here, as follows, is the map of radial velocity maps and the dispersion. And here we see that dispersion values are pretty low, just in the disk and in the extended emission line regions. So it is not an outflow from the active galactic disk. If there is, dispersion values will be pretty high, higher than in the disk where gas rotates when the gas is dynamically cold. So we also built a model map, and we see that residuals of the extended emission line regions are higher than the residuals in the galactic disk, where we see in general gas rotates with the one with just one rotational curve, except of course the central, I guess, outflow from the nucleus, this blue spot, as you see. And these extended line regions are not follow the rotational curve of the galaxy. It, I guess, if it is a tidal debris, this gas in the process of falling on the galactic disk. And also we compared positional angles on different distances from the nucleus for stars and the gas, and we see they're pretty different. So gas and the stars are not rotating in the same plane in the even in the disk of the galaxy, and in the center they're just in really different planes. And also we guessed the first assumptions to understand the spatial orientation parameters. It was the first part of our work, but when we make these assumptions about spatial rotational parameters, we could find another thing, and I will say about this. So we want not only understand the kinematics of this extended land regions, but we also want to understand the nature, properties of active galactic nucleus as well. And another side of our work, we want to understand when this activity of galactic nucleus started and where it and when it stopped. So for the second problem, we have this really rare objects called faded AGNs. It is an object when we don't see enough luminous active nucleus, but we see these extended emission line regions ionized by the AGN, and their luminosity is high, so we couldn't describe it by the ongoing luminosity of the active galactic nucleus in the center of the galaxy. And it is, and this mechanism is obligated in this paper of Kiel and et al. And our question is, how could we determine when ongoing activity has started? And our guess is to model merging systems. So we started this work using a database Galmer to understand the initial conditions of the merging systems. It is a database consists of numerical of the cubes where it's just counted how different types of pairs evolve. So we wanted to find maybe for first of all morphological the conditions when we find the same morphology of the interacting galaxies as we see in observations. So we used first assumptions of Tuben et al. And we find in this database this pair. So it is really looks like they really look like each other. And of course, we want to compare maybe velocity fields. It is observational one for Makran 739, and this is a model map. So we should make we just made pseudo slits to understand the velocity distribution and our initial conditions are right or not. So we faced a few problems that we are solving now. It's just a start of this of this work in this area, but the first try was made. So our result is that in four galaxies in our sample, extended emission line regions are dynamically cold and probably relate to the tidal debris or external accretion, and there are no evidence for them to be a result of AGN-related outflows. And also, we've started a work modeling the merging systems evolution, and based of course, on the kinematic analysis we conducted to find an upper limit of the start of the AGN activity, because this activity could appear in the process of merging, and we believe that is so. So thank you, and I would like to answer your questions if you have any.
Thank you, and we start with a question on site. If there is any question, I cannot see the people present there. So, is there any question?
No questions.
Please.
No questions here in the room.
We cannot hear very well. But
I said we have no questions here in the room.
Oh, okay. Then, is there any question? Online, yes, I see. Dragana, please go ahead.
Hi, Paola. Do you hear me well?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry that I missed the. I was just joining at the beginning, the first half of Daria's talk. I just, first of all, I want to say hello and nice to see you. And can you just briefly mention, maybe I missed this, how did you select these galaxies? I mean, based on what you selected these galaxies?
Okay, this sample is, first of all, this sample is for the galaxies in which we know that there are extended emission line regions that are confirmed and ionized by the AGN. They have an upper limit of luminosity in this case, but of course we use an archival data from the 6-meter telescope, so we hadn't made any new observation. So I guess it was it's not a whole sample. We will add another about 7 galaxies the sample, and I guess the main criteria is luminosity of the engine and these structures.
Thank you, and thank you very much for everything.
Thank you.
Is any other question online? I don't think so. So I would like to ask a question myself. And well, I think that your conclusion that there is basically a dynamical coordinates of the gas of the tended emitting region is quite interesting. And my question is, did you detect in the system a nuclear outflow, or could you go closer, you know, let's say within the inner kiloparsec from the nucleus? And in this case, could you find some evidence of outflow just close to the nucleus, or on the integrated spectrum of the nucleus?
Could I rephrase your question if I understood this correctly? How could we find an evidence for outflows from?
Well, and especially if there is any evidence of a nuclear outflow in the spectra of.
Can I get a comment?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can help, Daya. Hello, Alexei Moiseev. Collaborate of this. Hi, of all. Of course, in the central kiloparsec of the main part of this galaxy, we observe disturbed gas with a high velocity dispersion indicating wind on flow or jet cloud interaction, but only in the very center, in the central kiloparsec. Yes, we observed it.
Yes, so you could see this in this dispersion maps. There are high velocity dispersion values here, mm-hmm. about 20 hundredths of kilometer per second, and here too, just like about 20 hundredths of kilometer per second. So yes, and also we could detect it analyzing emission line profiles if there are any biconical outflows, but there are no evidence in radio data for large scale radio jets that could be a reason for these types of outflows. So I think that's the answer. Thank you for comment.
Thank you for asking my question. And well, I think if there are no other questions, we thank the speaker again, and also the last speaker of the morning before coffee break. And so.
Okay, thank you.